tonight. My name is Ivan Marils. I'm the Dean of Engineering. It's a real pleasure to welcome you here. Before I continue, please switch these devices off. It would be very much appreciated that they don't interrupt the lecture tonight. Can I start with acknowledging the traditional owners of the land in which the event is taking place, the land of the Wurundjeri people, and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Tonight's lecture is part of the Migunya Distinguished Visiting Fellows Program. Migunya is a large donation to the University of Melbourne that in 1993, on the recommendation of Russell and Matt Grimway Migunya Fund Committee, University Council established the Migunya Distinguished Visiting Fellowship Program. And tonight we have Professor David Scholl going to present as part of that lecture series. It enables overseas scholars of international distinction, in brackets, Nobel Prize winners like Perth people, to make an extended visit to the university and contribute to the university's academic, intellectual, and cultural life. And tonight we have really the honor of having Professor David Scholl, who is the John F. Brock III School of Chair of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering at Georgia Tech, speaking to us. David's research uses computational materials modeling to accelerate the development of new materials for energy-related applications, including the generation and storage of gases and liquid fuels and chemicals and carbon dioxide mitigation. He's a prolific publisher with over 300 papers. He has written a textbook on the density functional theory, quantum chemistry, method that is widely applied to the physical sciences and engineering. And he's a senior editor of ACS journal Langmuir, and that's one of the top journals in that space. Please help me to welcome to the lectern tonight Professor David Scholl, who is going to talk about what I think is divorce. Well, what nature has put together is very difficult to pull apart. And that's basically what I interpret as electrical engineer chemical separations to mean, but I'm pretty sure that David will give you a much more insightful discussion of this topic than that. David, please.
Thank you very much. All right, can you hear me? Yes, I think you can. Very good. First of all, it's a real pleasure to be here. As you will gather by listening to me for a little bit, I have an accent that is neither here nor there. I grew up in Australia, in Armidale, New South Wales, and then I went and did my PhD in the US and have been there ever since, and so my accent is a mixture of those things. Well, what I'd like to talk about tonight, I'd like to give you really a fairly general picture of how energy is used in the developed world, and then why this particular topic of chemical separations matters so much to chemical engineers, but more broadly to society in general. Ivan mentioned that I'm from Georgia Tech, and so just a little bit of an advertisement about Georgia Tech. We're in Atlanta. Atlanta has the world's busiest airport, 100 million passengers a year. The local joke is that when you die, you will go to heaven, but you will connect in Atlanta. Georgia Tech is a wonderful place to be an engineer or a scientist. We have the largest college of engineering in the U.S. All of our programs are very, very accomplished, and we have the largest chemical engineering program in the U.S. We have just over 1,000 undergraduate students and lots of wonderful things. So if you'd like to hear more about my colleagues in chemical engineering at Georgia Tech, I'd be happy to tell you about that. Well, let me begin by making what I hope is an obvious statement, which is the energy that we use is absolutely a cornerstone of the way we live our lives. I'd like to just imagine for a little bit what it would be like if we didn't have easy access to cheap energy. There would be many places, certainly many places in the United States, that would be unlivable without easy access to heating or cooling. If you go into your kitchen, essentially all of the food that we eat relies on having ready supplies of energy so that we can both produce the food, transport the food, but then store the food as well. Many, many of us rely on cars to get around. So here's a picture of what it sometimes looked like on the freeway near Georgia Tech. But again, life would be very difficult if we didn't have access to these things. And something that you're all familiar with, being in Australia, is the importance of air travel, something that absolutely would be impossible without liquid fuels to fuel those aircraft. So it's incredibly important, and in some sense, one of the key differences between the developed world and the developing world is access to energy, something that we take for granted, but something that is very, very important to the way we live our lives. Now, in the rest of the talk, I'm going to talk about a whole bunch of numbers that have to do with the way we use energy and things that we might be able to do with it. And it's important to remember that numbers are useful for telling a story, but you've got to be careful how you think about them. To give you an example, here's a first prediction. Solar energy use in the U.S. will grow by 10 to 12% annually until 2040. Now, if someone tells you that they could invest your money and get a 10% return every year until 2040, either they're crazy or you should give them the money, because that is a great return on investment. Second prediction. Solar energy will supply 3% of all U.S. energy in the year 2040. That doesn't sound so exciting. Turns out both of these are true. So these are both consistent with the U.S. Energy Information Administration forecast. The EIA is, I'm happy to say, a non-political part of the U.S. government, but their job is to provide careful scenario analysis of energy use in the U.S. and, in fact, around the world. So both of those facts are true, and we'll see as we go through the talk that it's important, as I said, sort of be a little bit careful in the way that we think about these numbers. Now, the saying that is often attributed to Yogi Berra and some other people is important here. It's tough to make predictions, especially about the future. So a lot of the things that I'll be talking about are predictions, but they are consistent with not just one group of people's thinking, but really a wide range of folks who look at these issues. All right, so let's look at how energy is used. And what I've done here is I've divided roughly my lifetime into 25-year chunks. Now, I'm going to refer to 2015 as now. And the reason is that it's easy to get high-quality information for 2015. It's also a lot easier to add and subtract 25 to 2015. So, first of all, I want all of you who are younger than me to think about how old you will be in 2040. I certainly plan to still be around in 2040. Many of you will be hopefully only in the middle of your careers. Okay, so the point that I want you to take away is 2040 is not some far-off science fiction thing in the future. It's something that you should actually be planning for. So even though Uber's going to have built the flying car by then, 2040 is a real thing that we should think about. Now, a useful way to do that is actually to look back in time. And so let me just give you a couple of things that were happening. So 25 years ago, the U.S. decided that it wasn't good anymore to smoke when you're on a plane. So that was banned. And Harry Potter was just starting to be written 25 years ago. If you go back 25 years prior to that, 1965, Bob Dylan had sprung out his electric guitar, and the Tom and Jerry cartoons had just started. Now, the other thing I've shown you there is the change in the world population over this time. So there's been very, very significant world population growth, certainly over the last 50 years. That will attenuate somewhat in the coming 25 years. Well, now let's look at how the United States has used energy during that time. So we'll start with 50 years ago or so, in 1965. The units here are in quads. A quad is a quadrillion BTUs. It doesn't matter what that unit is, it's just some gigantic amount of energy. Okay, so it's just a measure of total energy. And so there were 54 quads used in 1965. 94% of that was fossil fuel. 0.1% was nuclear. This was 20 years after the end of the Second World War, but the commercial nuclear industry in the U.S. had only just started at that point. And you might be surprised to see that renewable energy was 6.3%. Essentially, all of that renewable energy was hydroelectric power. So let's jump forward to 1990. So energy use increased to 85 quads. The only significant difference here in terms of the mix is that now 7% of all the energy in the U.S. came from nuclear power. I'm going to make the case that this represents probably the largest single change in the mix of energy in a developed country, at least in my lifetime. So this was an enormous change to go from nothing in nuclear to 7% nuclear in a 25-year span. Let's continue forward to 2015. So you can see Nuclear is now 8.6%. Renewables have risen to about 9.8%. Again, almost all of the renewables there is hydroelectricity. Almost none of it's down in the noise is wind, solar, and so on. The main thing I want you to notice here is it's almost all fossil fuels. So even now, we're at 82% fossil fuels. The forecast in the EIA 25 years from now is that we'll have gone all the way down to 78% fossil fuels. So one message is that when we're training young chemical engineers these days, if they want to go and work in the oil and gas industry, that is a stable career. You can look forward to a long, long career of helping us use hydrocarbons. There will be some increase in renewables, but it's a very incremental change. One of the messages that I'm trying to show you here is that the rate at which we change our energy mix is very, very slow. All right, now at the moment you might be thinking, well, those Americans, you know, they can't organize anything. So let's look at what Australia's doing. I don't have quite as much information on Australia, but I do have information on today and 25 years ago. So 25 years ago, the units here are different, doesn't really matter. 94% was fossil fuel. Australia, of course, has no nuclear industry, and it was 6% renewables. Again, most of the renewables there being hydroelectric. So, well, you can decide whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, but now I want you to predict for a moment what you think it is now or in 2015. So here are the numbers. They're actually the same. Absolutely identical. The only thing that has changed is the total amount of energy, and it scales very, very well with the population. So Australia has actually made essentially no change in where it gets its energy from in the last 25 years, except that there's now extensive use of natural gas rather than oil. So it's one fossil fuel, natural gas instead of coal. So it's one fossil fuel instead of another. All right, so now the problem with this is it seems like it's moving very, very slowly. This is particularly true when we think about how technology creeps up on us today. So here I have a chart showing how rapidly Instagram grew during its first 4 years of existence. Now, I'm far too old to even understand what Instagram is, let alone why it's a good thing. So someone can maybe explain that to me later. But this is pretty typical of an internet business. Notice that the timeline here is marked in months. And for an investment of about $60 million over these 4 years, they've gone from nothing up to something like 100 million users. Now, one of the challenges I think that happens certainly in the venture capital community now is people are used to this way of thinking. And they want things to happen in 2, 3, 4 years. And it's very difficult for them to understand that sometimes things are going to go much slower. So that really brings me to comparing again this to the U.S. energy mix. Changing the U.S. energy mix by 10% in a quarter of a century, that amounted to creating the entire nuclear industry in the United States. There are university departments of nuclear engineering. There are gigantic corporations that build the equipment. There's enormous electric utilities that build these plants and maintain them. I mean, it's a trillion-dollar investment. And so what I'll talk about really for the rest of the time today is why does it take so long to do these things? Okay, so we've talked about how much energy is used. Now let's talk about what it's used for. So this pie chart shows fairly recent information on how energy is used in the United States. There's 100 quads used, give or take. It's a nice round number to think about. And it turns out that it's almost equally split between transportation is one-third. That's all liquid fuel. Commercial and residential is a third. And then industry is a third. So one-third, one-third, one-third. A couple of observations about this. The first is that if you think about industrial energy use, that's almost all heat. And so if you start thinking about solar energy, wind energy, the classic renewables, they are really not going to make any impact in that sector, at least in the foreseeable future. So there are very, very large sectors of the economy where the kinds of renewables that people like to think about are just not able to have any impact. The other observation here is that, at least in the U.S., the chemical industry is growing very rapidly. There are many, many billions of dollars of new investment being made in the U.S. chemical industry. And at least one forecast by the EIA says that the energy that's used for making chemicals will grow by 80% in the next 25 years. And so if you look at the total change in energy use in the US, actually a lot of that's going to be associated with the chemical industry. Now, an interesting subpoint in this figure is how the chemical industry uses energy. It turns out that a great deal of that energy, perhaps half of it, is used to separate chemicals. Separating chemicals is a pretty unexciting thing to do. It's not intellectually a complicated thing to do, but it takes a tremendous amount of energy. So let me show you why that's true. So as much as 10% of all the energy in the US is basically used to boil things, because that's how we chemically separate things. This picture is a little bit difficult to see, but it's a cartoon that illustrates how distillation works. And if you think about distillation, there are oil refineries that refine something like 2 liters of crude oil per person on the planet every day. So for every one of us in the room, there's 2 liters today, there'll be 2 liters tomorrow, 2 liters the next day. That's also true for every person in Africa or every person in Asia. It's a tremendous amount of stuff. And when we go through this distillation, effectively what you do is you take crude oil and you heat it up from the temperature of this room up to incredibly high temperatures, 600-700 degrees Celsius. So maybe it's easy now to understand that we really use a lot of energy in terms of doing that. To give you another example, the chemicals that are used to produce ethylene, which is a precursor to polyethylene, those are produced on the scale of 200 million tons a year. So that means for every person in this room, there's 30 kilograms of either ethene or propene that is produced. Again, that's a lot of stuff for some chemical that probably a lot of you have never heard of. But again, it's something that we certainly use in our modern society. I've got a photograph here of a new chemical plant that Dow Chemical has just opened in Freeport, Texas. And so it's difficult to see on the picture here, but you know that in Texas everything is big. So these things are large pickup trucks. Gives you some sense of the scale here. The main thing you can see at this plant is a very, very large column. That column is on the order of 100 meters high and about 15 meters wide. And it's basically filled with these liquid chemicals. In this case, they're distilled at cryogenically low temperatures. The temperatures in that column are as low as minus 160 degrees centigrade. So you have this gigantic column sitting in the Texas sun, chilled down to incredibly cold temperatures because it's fundamentally difficult to separate ethane and ethene, two very similar molecules where it's ethene that we want. Probably you're wondering, do we really have to do it this way? Is there some process that we could use that would use less energy? The answer, at least in principle, is absolutely yes. So things that many of the folks here at the University of Melbourne work on and all around the world in terms of the research community work on are membrane-based methods where we can pass a mixture of those chemicals over the membrane and hopefully get effectively just the chemical that we want coming through the other side. It's not quite as simple as that, but that's basically how it works. And you can do it with certainly 10 times less energy than distilling it. So the question is, why don't we do that? First of all, we know how to make membranes at scale. This is a technology that's actually used quite widely in Australia because it's now the standard technology for water desalination. I have a couple of photos here from a large desalination plant in Israel, but these are actually very similar to plants that have been built in Australia in the last few years. I want you to look at the timeline at the bottom, though. So the first experiments were done on these kinds of membranes in about 1950. There weren't real progress until there were some patents in the late 1970s. That was gradually commercialized, and we're now at a point where essentially these membranes are the dominant commercial technology. But I want you to notice that it took about 25 years from research until when this was actually a commercial technology. So I'll just repeat the question I mentioned before. Why does it take so long to do this? If it's such a great technology, why don't we just do it quicker? Well, there are several issues, and it's helpful to look at this picture of the chemical plant again and to realize that building that chemical plant cost approximately $1 billion. If you're building a, quote, small chemical plant, that might be only $300 million. Now, put yourself in the shoes for a moment of the person who makes the ultimate decision to build that plant. You personally are committing this company to spend $1 billion. What is the thing that is foremost in your mind? Don't screw up, right? You have absolutely zero tolerance for any risk in any technology that's going to go into that plant. You are not going to put anything into that plant that you're not completely sure already works. Now, why do we build them so big? There are certain economies of scale that mean when you're making a commodity chemical like ethylene, you just have to make the plant really big before it's economically viable to do that. The fact that it costs $1 billion means that that plant has to operate for at least 30 years continuously, or it's just going to lose the company money from day one. And so you're talking about a very long investment here. And the bottom bullet point is really the key problem in this area. No one wants to take the risk. No one wants to build the first plant of anything. And it's a very difficult barrier to overcome. All right, so now let's look at it from the research side and think about what it might take to actually develop these new technologies. And so I'm taking here an example from some of my colleagues at Georgia Tech who are actually developing a particular class of membranes that we think, if everything worked correctly, could revolutionize that gigantic plant that you saw that the Dow Chemical Company had built. So I've put here in the regular font things that we've already done with how much money it cost and how long it took. So we did some initial lab, my colleagues did some initial lab demonstrations that cost something like $1 million, took about 3 years. From a research point of view, it was incredibly successful. They published a paper in Science. This was really exciting stuff. We now are in the middle of a one-year project, spending $500,000 to scale that up to, in a very, very minor degree, really to scale it up just from one thing that I could hold in my hand very easily to four things that I could hold in my hand. That's $500,000. The next stage would be to do what I would call very small-scale tests. That's certainly going to cost a few $1 million and will take several years. Then to really de-risk this technology, you've got to build a pilot plant and operate it for some time. You have to operate it for at least 2 to 4 years. That's going to cost something like $20 million to do that. And then before we actually go to that giant-sized chemical plant, then someone has to implement this at an actual working facility. That's going to cost at least $100 million. So this is just for one technology. The same timeline and cost structure applies to almost any technology that would displace distillation in the chemical industry. And the natural question then is, well, who's going to pay for this? At least in the U.S., I've done a pretty careful analysis of how much federal funding is available, or maybe I should say was available. You never know these days how much is available. But at least recently, the total U.S. R&D investment from government funding in chemical separations was about $35 million a year. Now, it sort of sounds like a lot of money. If someone says, I'm going to give you $35 million to do something, it sounds good. But from a countrywide perspective, that turns out to be just about 11 cents per person. Now, just to calibrate you there, if you add up how much all the baseball players earn in the U.S., they earn 100 times that, $3.6 billion. So everyone in the U.S. pays $11 each year for the privilege of having people play baseball. You might want to calibrate that against Australia, by the way. So I found out the AFL payroll, that turns out to be about $8 per person. So, you know, you can decide whether that's worthwhile or not. The problem you can see, though, is the significant disparity that exists between at least government funding that's available to do these things and the actual costs. And so there's a real challenge here, and I think, you know, some of us spend a lot of time now working with industrial partners and trying to talk with government partners as well to try and generate some understanding of the scale of these problems, but also of what would be required to really make changes in doing them. Now, if you spend time thinking about how we make big changes in technology and how much money it costs, there are a couple of other examples that almost always come up. So I want to anticipate a couple of those because it also is then helpful to think about, well, what would it take to really change things in a dramatic way? So the first example that comes up is the Manhattan Project during the Second World War, between about the years of, say, 1941 and 1945. The U.S. government decided it needed to build an atomic weapon, which they successfully did. It's really a marvelous technical achievement. Of course, it led to many other complications that we're now dealing with in the modern world. One estimate is that this project involved 130,000 people, and at least in modern dollars, cost something like $26 billion. So put it in that way, it's perhaps not surprising that they were able to achieve something. You know, hopefully if my research budget was increased to, I'll just say $2.6 billion, then, you know, I'd be pretty convinced that I could get something useful done. The other example that you maybe have already thought of is the Apollo program. So this was a program in about a decade that went from nothing to putting man on the moon. By the way, if you haven't seen the movie Hidden Figures, I absolutely highly recommend it. It makes an incredibly compelling case for the necessity for diversity in science and engineering. It also makes engineering look really, really cool. So it's a great, great thing. All right, the Apollo program, how much did that cost? That cost about $109 billion, at least in 2010 dollars. So the point here is that, yes, it is possible to make technical changes on a rapid time scale of, say, 5 to 10 years, but only by investing truly enormous amounts of money. That's actually consistent. If you think what I told you about the change in the energy mix in the U.S., if you tried to estimate how much money was spent to develop the U.S. nuclear industry, it would be hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars in modern terms. So the challenge is that we have an energy system that is very, very stable, that in many ways works very well. There are ways that we can change it, but they will require absolutely massive investment in order to get there. So what I'd like to do is leave you with a couple of messages from the talk, and then I think we have time for discussion. I've often found this is a topic that I think we can have some interesting discussion around. The first is that I hope it's obvious, maybe I didn't state it before, but if we can reduce the amount of energy we use, that's a fundamentally good thing to do. That will have tremendously positive societal benefits, environmental benefits, and also benefits for folks in the developing world who would like to live the kind of lifestyle that we have. The second thing is that there are enormous amounts of energy that are not visible to most of us because they occur behind plant boundaries. And in many ways, if governments want to change how energy is used, there's much more that can be done here that can be done by affecting individual consumers. Because things are much more concentrated, it's much easier to leverage by regulation and by incentives than it is if you're trying to deal with many, many millions of individuals. The final comment is that anyone who tells you they can change how energy is used, either in the US or Australia, by 10% in just a few years, they're almost certainly wrong. You look at history, and you can just say, this has never, ever happened before, and so why will it happen now? Now, just as an example, which a not-so-hypothetical example, perhaps, it turns out that if we went to having 50% of the electricity in Australia come from renewables, that would represent a 10% change in Australia's energy mix. And so there have been discussion of making very large-scale changes in the electricity use in this country, and I think it's useful to look at that in a historical context and say, you know, that sounds like at least a challenging thing to do, and then to think of it from that perspective. So I hope I've shown you, first of all, that chemical separations do actually matter. They matter so much that we use a significant fraction of all of our energy in the developed world to achieve these chemical separations. We just could not live the life that we have without those kinds of chemical separations. I hope I've also shown you that there are fundamental reasons why it's difficult to change the way we use energy quickly. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try, but it does mean that being aware of what those barriers are, I think, can help us have a reasonable chance of being successful. So with that, I'll thank you for your attention. I'd be very happy to entertain your questions.
We have
have some roving mics that will help us to handle questions, and David will answer. And I also want to remind people, I should have done that at the beginning, but we're actually taping the lecture, at least from an audio perspective. So if you don't want your voice being recorded, no questions. Otherwise, feel free.
Use sign language.
Feel free, David.
Thank you very much. It seems to me that the economic rewards have got to improve benefit for efficiency, because it seems to me that what you've highlighted is a waste of heat. And while greenhouse gases in the negative at present, it'll come back, the need to control it. And it seems to me that what you're saying, we need to also control heat from all these things.
Yeah, I think that the point you're making is a very good one, that one of the ways that societally we can change these things is by changing the incentives.
Yeah.
You know, and certainly I'd say in the commodity chemical industry, people are not driven by altruism at all, but they are driven by fear of regulation. And so that, you know, sensible regulation really makes a big difference. Now, certainly one of the challenges in the US, I think all around the world, is that these regulations need to be stable over a long period of time for people to actually act on them. So that's another level of challenge, I think.
If I may add to that one, there is a thermodynamic limit in the second law of thermodynamics that says you don't get anything for free. And for most of our thermal process, you lose 2/3, no matter what you do, and that's under good conditions. So efficiency is not always what it looks like.
Yeah, it can be hard, right, it can be hard to... But I think the idea that you're mentioning is that we need to incentivize the right kinds of behaviors,
yeah,
because that will then make a long-term difference.
Hello. I don't know if you can answer this question. What you've made quite clear is that to make a difference requires a huge amount of money and a huge amount of effort. Why, knowing that, there is such a negative attitude towards alternative energy, when really a solution for alternative energy is so far away and requires such resource? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. It's a very deep question, and I don't think there's a simple answer to it. Certainly one of the challenges that exists, I think, in almost any democratic system, is that government, going back to this idea of incentives, governments really don't have an incentive to plan on the decadal timescale, but that's what's required. You know, and again, if you imagine you put yourself in the government's position, your main interest is getting reelected, and so it's very difficult to take that very, very long view. The other thing I think is that a lot of these issues are quite subtle. And so even for people in governmental organizations that do take a long view and really want to make positive changes, figuring out how to actually communicate that to the general population and make it palatable is a rather difficult thing to do.
Yeah. Because my sense is you're saying knock yourself out, because it's actually very hard to do, but the government doesn't give that message out, basically. What you're saying, to make a difference, you really have to knock yourself out.
Yeah, I think that's true. Well, I guess what I'm saying is that in any of these technology areas, and in any technology, it's hard to tell whether it's going to be a winner in the end, but there has to be a very sustained and eventually a very significant investment to try it out. Yeah.
I have a more technology related question. You showed like how much energy is used for the separations, right? But what would actually be like the limit you could actually save? Let's say like we maintain the chemicals we use and go from all the thermal processes to very efficient mechanical separation processes. How much would be left in the end still?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I don't have the answer on the top of my head in the units that I showed you, but the Department of Energy in the US has done what they call a bandwidth study, where they've worked exactly that out. And so they estimate the total energy savings that are available both going back to what Ivan mentioned, just the thermodynamic limit, but then also sort of a realistic estimate of given best technologies. And I'm sorry, I don't remember the number, but it's truly an astonishing amount of energy. Right. And so, but the problem is that you have the sunk costs in these plants, that once you've built it, you're going to use it for 30 years. You know, you're not going to go and invest another $500 million to change it, because it doesn't change your bottom line that much.
Thanks.
Yes.
Coming.
Thank you, David. Richard Henning. I was fascinated by your diagram that indicated that perhaps the population of the world was going to asymptote, and you were at 9 million, nine billion, and the wealth of nations is actually proportional to the energy they consume. So in other words, a lot of people are going to consume much more energy. And also your diagram indicated that fossil fuels are going to be very much a major concern still. And if fossil fuels are going to be the contributor to greenhouse gas warming, what's separation going to do to actually resolve that problem?
Well, you managed to pack a lot into a question there, but everything you said is correct. So one of the other implications, by the way, is that most of the growth in energy use in the world in the next 25 years will be in the developing world. So the actual growth in energy use in the developed world will be modest. So this issue of, what do we do about greenhouse gases? Now, of course, there's a fantastic chemical separations problem there. Right? Because what we'd like to do is to separate the CO2 that we're making by burning fossil fuels from various sources. And so there are many, many people in Australia, a wonderful centre here at the university working on that. There's a lot of different ways to do it. One interesting opportunity, there's the whole range of opportunities, but one I'll highlight is the cement industry. So it turns out that making cement is actually a fairly significant contributor to world anthropogenic CO2. And so there's some interesting opportunities there. But it's the challenge now goes back to the incentives, that no one's going to pay you to capture CO2. You know, it's always going to cost you, it has to cost you money to do it, and so people are only going to do it if they're compelled to for some reason. So there's a lot of difficult societal questions wrapped up with some difficult technical questions as well.
Thank you, David. That was an interesting, very interesting description of the issues that we have in relation to timescales and decisions that need to be made. And you made the point very effectively that these things take a very long time. My question is about reflecting on how we make the decisions about which technology to go forward. Have we got that right? How do we do it more effectively? You showed one technology. There are probably half a dozen up there that could be used in that
particular area. Absolutely, yes.
Where do we put our money and how do we make that decision?
That is a really good question, Jeff. I think one of the key things as you go sort of up that scale of spending money on things, you have to get rapidly more serious about doing techno-economic analyses. And so really at the end of the day, you have to do a very serious techno-economic analysis and decide whether the technology has legs. And you have to be willing to say no. That's, as academics, that's the thing that we're not good at. We want to keep working on our pet technology forever, right? But what we're doing, so I'm part of a large consortium funded by the DOE in the US where we're going to be looking at these sort of more advanced stage technologies. And it's very, very metric driven. And we have folks doing independent economic analysis. So you have to ask hard questions and be willing to say no to things.
Thank you for a fascinating lecture. I'm just wondering, with the current chemical processes, is there any research being done on how to make use of the waste energy, which is greater than what's actually used in the processes?
Yeah, so if you go to a chemical plant, people are very, very serious about what's called heat integration. So, you're heating up one thing and cooling down another and making sure that all of that works. And so these plants really are very carefully optimized to do that. The research opportunity that exists is really to do with what's called low-grade heat. So there are things like thermoelectric materials where you can take very small temperature differentials and convert that into electricity. So there's actually a lot of active research in this area. But I think it's something where there's still a big sort of gulf between what people actually do in the chemical plant and what, maybe might be possible. It's a great question.
David. I used to work for a chemical company, and we had a timescale of 14 years from when we discovered something on the bench to when it became what we call a tier two product. I think the example you gave, if I added the years up, it came to about the same number.
Yeah.
That number actually hasn't changed since 1950. So the question is, how do we do that part of it better and quicker?
Yeah.
Because allowing for the fact that you build 30 and 40 year plants, in the chemical and what we call the separations industry, we still haven't broken that barrier at all.
That is a great question. And I think, so I think in my wildly optimistic dreams, I can imagine compressing that time from 15 years to 10 years. And that I think that would actually be a huge success for society if collectively the engineering community could do that. I think one of the challenges is that you simply have to run some of these processes for a long time to learn from doing them. You know, you probably know from your own experience that often when you do things in a lab and then you take it out to the field, there are minor impurities that you didn't know about that all of a sudden become the entire business. So that's, but I mean, I think that's a really important issue for the entire chemical engineering community to think about. And it's, there's not one thing that we can do, but if we could start to, you know, trim 6 months here and a year there, it would actually add up to a lot in the end.
At the beginning, you spoke of the Israeli desal plant you showed us. We currently have near Kilcunda in Gippsland a desal plant perceived by the community generally as a failed white elephant. Do you know whether that is a membrane technology plant?
Sandra says yes, it is. Without even knowing the answer, I would say yes, but it is. I mean, that now is the technology that's used all over the world. Partly because the energy use is incredibly lower than more old-fashioned techniques like essentially boiling the water.
Thank you very much for the lecture, John Scott. Thinking of the societal aspect, we have food labelling where the jars tell us how much sugar, how much carbohydrate, whatever it might be. How about energy accounting, where we develop incentive for change in society by increasing awareness, general awareness, of what the energy costs of the various things we use might be?
Yeah, John, I think that's a great idea. You know, it'd be interesting to see how effective that actually is. You know, I think in examples where energy markets, where consumer energy markets have been deregulated, essentially everyone's just driven by cost. People are not really interested in how the energy is made or where it comes from. But I do think, I mean, you know, if we think back to the time when we didn't have food labeling, people really look at things differently now. And as you said, it's not just the content of the food, but where did it come from and so on. So I think that's actually a really interesting idea that would be deserve more thought.
Hi, very interesting presentation. I had a few comments on the discussion that went around. In fact, one of the Israeli technologies to desalinate water, we have three of them operating in India, but that's on evaporation, not membranes, where actually the refinery low-level heat has been integrated.
Okay, great, yes.
With a 14-effect evaporator system. And Reliance Refinery in Jamnagar, which is one of the largest in the world, actually operates on desalinated seawater for cooling purposes and stuff like that. And that desalination is again using Israeli technology, but again evaporation, okay? But that's a clear indication of how low-level heat can be used.
Yeah, it's a great example.
To evaporate water.
Yep.
My real question was that you did touch about the transportation sector in your energy mix, because you know, we still use gasoline and diesel, and I think that's still almost 100% as compared to the percentage that you talked about. In India, in fact, I'm from India and part of the developing world, and the Minister for Energy, renewable energy, for example, he mentioned that by 2040, India would go completely on electric vehicles. I just wanted your take on this. I mean, I don't kind of believe it, but
It's a very interesting question. So first of all, let me say I drive an electric vehicle. It's a plug-in hybrid. I refer to it as my CO2 elsewhere vehicle because the electricity comes from coal-fired power plants. It's just that I'm not putting it out of my car. I think actually that the really interesting opportunity that is embedded in your question is that in the developing world and places like India, there are opportunities to reimagine what the energy mix will look like. And so there are opportunities that are incredibly different from an existing society mix like Australia or the US. And so I'm not going to offer an opinion on whether I think it's realistic to just have electric cars in India. But certainly that the opportunity to think creatively and to take a long-term look at those issues, I think, is a wonderful opportunity.
Thank you. It's a fascinating talk. I'm interested in the idea of the incentives. We talked, much of it is around government incentive, but I wonder if the incentive is a commercial incentive that's already there. So I think your takeaway that you have there is that the big change will not be in changing the energy mix, but in reducing energy usage. So have you got the numbers, or do you know the numbers, or could you calculate them? What does a company like Dow... What does Dow spend on chemical separations? How much would they save if they changed to this technology? And then why don't they invest that saving in developing the technology? Isn't there a commercial incentive already there to companies like Dow, and why don't they invest?
It's a great question. So I think in principle the incentive exists, but from their point of view of writing that $1 billion check for the new plant, the technology is not already demonstrated. So it's a chicken and egg problem, really. Certainly I work with people in Dow and they understand the potential for these methods, but they're just having a challenge of how do we get there. So I think, by the way, I didn't mention why did Dow spend $1 billion to build that plant. It's because of the availability of cheap natural gas in the US. That's the only reason. 10 years ago, the uniform opinion in the chemical industry in the US was no new chemical plant will ever be built, ever, in the US. They're all going to be built in Malaysia, China. Well, at the moment, there are tens of billions of dollars a year being spent building new chemical facilities in the US, and it's because of the availability. So the economic reality changed, and so people certainly will change their plans according to the economic reality, but it's a long road to get there.
David, from all of us, thank you very much for a very fascinating talk. Very much enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And that concludes the proceedings for tonight. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you will be able to visit us for the other Dean's lectures later in the year. Thank you very much.
I gather from the introduction that you're around for a while.
I am. I'm going to be gone next week, but I'm back for about a month.
Because I'm interested in what you're doing today. And that's the computation of the book.
And
that's the computation of it, which is an area I'm trying to get here. Having initially spoken,
yes,
going down.
Okay,
great. Yeah. I met him at Georgia Tech a few years ago.
Okay.
And I'm trying to do something here, trying to build a computational program here.
Yeah.
So if you're here for the next...
Yeah, I'm basically here for all of you.
How do I contact you? Okay, I'll do that.
I'm sitting.
I'll leave you.
Yeah, okay. No, what's it?
All right.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks.
Yeah, we're actually Oh, we make sure we pack this up. You should go for dinner. I've just realised we've got to walk all the way back. I thought we were having dinner here.
She's still there.
Right.
Yes.
In fact, we're in the same building.
Yes, can we carry anything?
Because I'm just about to ride the truck.
That seems like the most likely outcome.
Yeah. She was chapters with EPA, Scott, or was she shot?
Yeah, I can't understand that.
He's
in favour of what I'm saying, but whether he's got the ear of people. Because it's a huge using, particularly here in Australia, using all the fossil fuel.
No, it's a very, very complicated issue. That's for sure.
It's a classic example of group thinking. You've got to think like a group, don't think like a group, get off the side. And that's what the settled science is. The people who have tried to move outside the group have all been totally neglected. You can't get the papers published. Trump was a big opportunity.
Well, the irony is, you know, Trump was all for using coal. The reason the U.S. uses less coal now is already economic. It's so natural gas. It is, but that, you know, so people, so the coal industry is declining in the U.S., so it isn't because the government overregulated them or something, it's just because, you know, it's a lot cheaper to grow now. But I agree with you.
Rubbish. Yes, thank you. I don't know if anything else is. Should we ask?
Is there something out here?
Is there?
recording of, like, an audio recording?
Yeah.